Thank you for listening to Psychedelic Parenting, a service of Awakening Families. If you like what you hear, consider a tax-deductible gift to this work through our fiscal sponsor, MAPS, or use one of our Amazon links when you're buying the things you need.
Want to share with their young people the grandeur and the glory that they are encountering.
What's really important is the felt presence of direct experience. We have to stop consuming our culture. We have to create culture. Create your own roadshow. Space and time, where you are now, is the most immediate sector of your universe.
Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan. With me today is Stephen Gray. Stephen is the author of the new book, Cannabis and Spirituality. He's also one of the founders of the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference in Vancouver, where I met him 2 years ago. And we're very excited to have Stephen on today, as we've just been breaking into his book, Cannabis and Spirituality. And I found it extremely compelling. One of the things that I really like about it is that it has some really practical advice for how to incorporate cannabis into a spiritual practice. And as I've heard many things in the past about cannabis as a spiritual tool, as an entheogen, one of the things that I haven't seen very much of is practical advice on how to achieve this. So I'm very excited to find out more from Stephen and hear about his book, and to tell all of our listeners to run out and get it, because it's really exciting. So welcome back to the show again, Stephen.
Ah, thank you, Jonathan. Happy to be here.
So why don't you start out by telling us how you were inspired to bring together all of these authors for this anthology?
Okay, if I had an hour, I'd go way, way back. The shorter version that will probably suffice is that I've been involved with the psychedelics / entheogens for quite a number of years now. And I got involved with, as you mentioned, co-organizing the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference. And somewhere, I'm not sure when the birth of the idea, you know, came to life for me, but at some point I noticed, this was probably 6-7 years ago now, it occurred to me that as we were seeing cannabis spread its wings rapidly around the world, really, for multiple uses and gaining legal recognition medically, et cetera, even recreationally in a number of jurisdictions, and just becoming part of the entering into the mainstream more and more, there was one particular function or capability of the plant, and some of us might even claim, perhaps a little hesitantly, but that it's the most powerful capability of the plant, and that is its spiritual use. Mm-hmm. And despite the fact that when you look into it, when you do some reading, you see that there's clear evidence that cannabis has been used as a spiritual ally for a very, very long time on this planet, and has widespread use throughout Asia, Europe, Africa, more recently North America, or the Americas, I mean. So it seemed like an oversight or something that needed attention. And then about almost 5 years ago now, well, 4.5 years ago, I was having a conversation with Kathleen Harrison about that. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, I'd kind of like to, you know, address this or redress this problem, and but I don't think I have a full book in me myself. And she said, well, you know, if you wrote that book or put that book together, I would contribute. I think that would be an important book. And that was the light that went off for me, because Kathleen Harrison is a remarkable being and a fine writer. And mm-hmm. So I just started looking for people to contribute and ended up with 17 plus myself.
Wow, that's great. Yeah. So yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your co-conspirators here, and maybe tell a little bit about maybe what each person's contribution, or maybe just the highlights of the contributions that you've put together?
Oh, sure. I'll have to be quick with all that many. one of the first people I asked was Jeremy Wolfe, who's, I'm not going in order here because his chapter is somewhere around chapter 15. Mm-hmm. But I had read a chapter, an essay by him in Julie Holland, the book that Julie Holland edited called The Pop Book. Yeah. And I thought it was brilliant. So I wrote him and asked him if he would contribute to this book, and he said yes. And then, and so he's just, while we're on him, he's, I don't know exactly what I'd call him, but he's writing more as like a social philosopher, I would say, like that. Very interesting ideas. It's an ideas chapter. It's very interesting. He's very, very insightful, and very experienced with cannabis and entheogens in general, I think. So that leads me back to the foreword, because it finally dawned on me that Julie Holland is Jeremy's partner.
Right.
So I asked him if I thought Julie might be interested in contributing a foreword, and so I communicated with her, and she was very happy to do that. And although it's quite short, it's really packed with a few little beautiful gems. That it's only like a 2 or 3 page foreword, but it's quite lovely. Actually, I'm staring at one of the quotes. If you'd like to hear it.
Oh, sure.
Cannabis can unlock us from our habitual way of doing things, and more importantly, of thinking about things. It pulls us out of our forward-leaning vector. This is a phrase that's got stuck in my mind. I love pulling us out of our forward-leaning vector idea, encouraging us to hang back, wait a bit, and see how things feel before rushing into anything. It puts us in touch with our deepest longings and our truest feelings. It enables contemplation and reflection. That was lovely.
That is lovely.
Forward. I wrote an introduction. Then Kathleen Harrison, who I mentioned a few moments ago, wrote a beautiful chapter. She's just such a warm, intimate, and insightful person and writer. It's called Who Is She? I forget the subtitle, something about how we personify cannabis. Mm-hmm. Just talks about the respect that the more respect you bring to your encounters with the plant, the more she reveals. And she talks about that too, the feminine quality of it, the receptive yin quality of the plant. It's a beautiful chapter. And she also has a couple of very interesting cautions in there about how people can be seduced by this plant, and it can take them away from, I think, what she called the daylight world of responsive relationship, you know? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to, for those people that, well, I guess a lot of people don't necessarily know the extent of this spiritual history of cannabis use, I wanted to put something in there to help kind of validate that. Mm-hmm. Chris Bennett is a leading scholar, written several books on the topic. So he's got a chapter in there called Venerable Traditions, where it's a survey, and it's a very
non-exhaustive.
Mostly focusing on Asia. It doesn't really too much about Europe, and definitely not about Africa, where there's a long-standing history of all kinds of use of cannabis, including the spiritual shamanic use. And then also, he doesn't really go into the Americas, but it gives you a good sense of how ancient the plant is.
I found that chapter, I think that chapter is a pretty good sort of like cliff notes of his book, Cannabis and the Soma Solution.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, he has another book, what's it called? Green Gold, The Tree of Life, which is also about cannabis in ritual and religion historically. And then the next chapter is Joan Bellow. It's called something, Marijuana and the Body Mind, I think. And she's really brilliant, I believe, as well. She has a little book that's been around for a long time called The Benefits of Marijuana. That book has done really well. It's actually self-published, but I've seen it in bookstores a lot. It's about 20 years old now, but she has some very, very interesting insights, and including some discussion of how the plant actually works biochemically in our bodies that have to do with this its spiritual benefits or effects, how it opens channels up and increases freshly oxygenated flow of blood throughout the system. It's kind of like the physical basis for this contention that cannabis is a potentially excellent spiritual medicine. Dee Dussault has a chapter in there. She's got a new book herself, actually. She's becoming one of the leading spokespeople for what they're now calling ganja yoga. Mm-hmm. So I wanted something in there about how other kinds of practices can work with cannabis. And so Dee has this, her last name is spelled Dussault. And she has a book coming out in April from Harper One called Ganja Yoga. Mm. So she just talks about some of her own experience, how she'd been doing yoga for a very long time before she used cannabis. She actually wasn't using cannabis at all. And then she, you know, so she had this really interesting grounding of having done a lot of yoga. And then she started including in cannabis in conjunction with her asanas, you know. Mm-hmm. And she went, whoa, this sort of sharpens and deepens everything dramatically. So that's an interesting idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a friend who actually just launched a YouTube channel. Uh-huh. She's out of Denver, her organization is called Ganjasana, and she actually leads cannabis yoga retreats in Denver area. She's an alumnus of Zoe Helene's Cosmic Sister Retreat.
Actually, that's where I heard about her, was through Zoe, because Zoe and her guy Chris Killam were here for the conference last fall.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, have you heard her speak to a group of people, by the way?
Rachel?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. No, but I'm working on trying to bring her here to Michigan for a cannabis patient retreat sometime, before the spring, I think. So I will hopefully have some experience with that before your conference rolls around next year. So
yeah, this year. I'm actively on the hunt for presenters for this year's conference right now. So I'm keeping my ears open. So then there's a chapter, it's an interview I did with Hamilton Souther. He had a place, I think, called Blue Morpho down in somewhere in South America, maybe Colombia.
Yeah, in Peru. Yeah.
Who was it? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Doing ayahuasca work. And then he, I believe he's still there, at least when I contacted him. He was living in Colorado, and he started Blue Morpho cannabis ceremonies or something to that effect. And he's got some very interesting things to say about cannabis, the spirit of cannabis. He says that there's a head medicine spirit of cannabis, and the most effective way to work with cannabis as a spiritual ally is if you or the shaman, actually. So he feels strongly that people should ideally do this work with cannabis in a ceremonial context with an experienced ceremony leader, or what he calls a shaman, who has an open channel with these head medicine spirits of the plant. Interesting idea.
How would your practice jive with that philosophy, do you think?
Well, maybe that requires a brief anecdote. Have you ever heard of the movie Thunderheart?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember it at all? There's Val Kilmer plays a...
Yes. It's the one that's like loosely based on the... the incident at Oglala, is that correct?
Yeah, in the Dakotas somewhere there. The FBI assigns Val Kilmer to go look into this. They're not doing very well with it because he's half Native, but he's rejected his Native half because his dad was a drunk or something like that. Mm-hmm. So he gets to meet Graham Greene, who's like the local sheriff, but has spent his whole life as a traditionalist and you know, spiritual practices and all that. And they're driving along in this pickup truck, and Val Kilmer is telling Graham Greene that he had a vision of being at Wounded Knee in 1871. Mm-hmm. And Graham Greene gets really pissed off at him and says, I can't believe it, you young punk. I've been studying this stuff all my life, and you've had a goddamn vision. So I kind of feel like the Graham Greene character, you know. For me, things tend to be more subtle than that, you know. Uh-huh. I wouldn't say I've ever encountered anything like an actual being that I could identify. It's more like, for me, the muse, you know, I sense the muse there, if that makes sense, you know. Similar with other entheogens, you know, people talk about seeing the spirit of ayahuasca or whatever, you know. I hear exactly, not literally in a sense, but voices, you know, communicating to me occasionally, you know, telling me to shut up and pay attention, for example, you know. Really, that happened. Yeah, one night with ayahuasca, we're getting a little off the track here, but just for the fun of it.
Are you sure?
I've connected with the Santo Daime people up here recently, really nice bunch. And I was sitting there and kind of going through my usual thing of sort of like, oh man, these people are all getting it and I'm not, or whatever, you know, you know, and sort of berating myself, but being in my head a little too much. And then I heard this silent voice say something to the effect of, just shut up and, you know, be quiet for a minute and we have something to show you. And so I just kind of smartened up. And with my eyes open, I saw this kind of throne up in the ceiling, sort of, you know, it was like a kind of a white throne. And it was immediately clear to me that this was, a representation of the Holy Spirit or whatever you want to call it. And I was like, oh, okay, thank you very much, you know. So my cannabis experiences are more kind of in that nature, you know, where I sense things. Oh, actually, this is kind of fun. I'm reading a really... Well, it's not an easy book to read, but it's fascinating. It's called Cannabis and Culture. I got it out of the library. It's very hard to get a hold of. It's not in print anymore. It was. It's the whole book is papers submitted to an international conference in 1973 by academics on cannabis culturally and historically. One of them is something about what's called the ganja vision in Jamaica. And apparently, it's not uncommon for initiates, well, not even initiates, but in the communities where cannabis is popular, ganja in Jamaica, this is just, say, going back here sometime, that first-time users would have an experience of seeing what they called a little lady, sometimes a little old lady. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because I've never thought that I've actually had an experience of contacting any kind of anything that I could identify as a spirit of cannabis. However, several times, I've always loved to dance freeform hippie style kind of dance. And so one night I was, had taken some of the herb and I had some music on and I was just dancing alone in my room. Or actually, not one night, several times. I've had this experience where I've got my eyes closed, the room's dark, essentially, and I'm just dancing in place, more or less. And I seeing a vision of a woman, kind of somewhat scantily dressed, looking like a native person of some kind, almost like a shamaness or something, in front of me, and we're dancing together. And she's kind of like guiding my movements, like we're in sync, effortlessly somehow. And when I read this bit about the ganja vision and the little lady, I thought, oh, well, maybe that is something to do with the cannabis spirit. So,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I don't know about Hamilton Souther and all that. That's what he says. I'll just take his word for it. And if it's useful to people, fine.
I've had very similar kind of experience with dancing. I've gotten into Arabic dancing in the last 6 months or so, and like belly dancing, and I found that smoking a little bit of ganja has definitely, like, sort of, you know, loosens up the body and gets you moving, and it's definitely feels like very feminine to me as well, and I have often, I don't know if you've ever mixed cannabis and DMT before, but I very often encounter extremely feminine entities on that mixture.
No, I have not done that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, when I'm dancing like that with cannabis, I do, I feel, at least partially feminine. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So, shall we skim through the remainder of the,
Yes, indeed.
Okay. So this fellow, it's a pen name, of course, LLP, because he's been a cannabis grower for many, many years in the UK, where it's been illegal all this time. So he's had to stay very underground about it, but I heard about him through some friends, and, I wanted something in there about the way that people approach growing. I thought this is important, as, you know, more and more people are going to be growing it, and more people are going to be using the plant grown by those people. Sure enough, he confirmed that he's convinced that if you take a sacred attitude or a very respectful kind of loving, actually he says, starts off with saying the first thing is right off the bat, you've got to love your plants. And if you take that attitude with every stage of the growing, then there will be a difference to the end user. And he claims that his friends have long, long confirmed that, where, you know, they just find there's something different about his medicine, his plants, than from pretty much anything else they had tried. So I want something in there about that. So it's on sacred growing.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And
then I wanted to find out a little bit, or I wanted people to know that there are, you know, more about there's some living traditions that are still working with cannabis spiritually. So there's a chapter by Jeff Brown, who was connected or an intimate member of a Rasta church. Mm-hmm. I won't say any more about that particularly, just the way he talks about the way they do things as a group and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of my favorite chapters is Satyan Raja, who lives here in Vancouver, just outside of Vancouver, but he's of East India, what we call East Indian extraction from India.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of Native Indians out here too.
Mm-hmm.
He led a group of people to the Kumbh Mela, which is the largest gathering of human beings on this planet.
Yeah. It's amazing. I've seen a couple of documentaries about the Kumbh Mela. It's pretty impressive thing.
So he tells this enticing story about how he met some of the insider kind of sadhus who ended up, he says they had a good feeling about him, and they invited him and his little group into the inner sanctums that normally no Westerner ever sees, and in fact almost no Indians ever see.
Mm-hmm.
And they just kept going into these tents, and then they go into the next one and the next one, where there was one guy called something T-Bob or something like 113 years old, you know, just sitting there holding his seat, you know, been living on milk for, you know, 90 years or something, you know, chai or something. So he has some wonderful stories about them in that chapter. And then Mariano da Silva is an ayahuasca shaman from Brazil, and I wanted to talk a little bit, or I wanted people to know a little bit about how cannabis can support work with other medicines, as you mentioned, you know, DMT earlier. His group of people that he works with in Brazil, where he's from, sometimes include cannabis, what they call Santa Maria, Saint Mary,
mm-hmm.
their ayahuasca ceremonies, very carefully, very respectfully. They do it later in the ceremony. He says that it's absolutely important that there be both external and internal silence. And when you do that, and there's a wonderful little phrase in this chapter, something to the effect of, in that circumstance, ayahuasca takes you to the top of the mountain, and the Santa Maria gives you wings to fly into the wind.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah. And also,
I understand that there's a number of Santo Daime traditions in Brazil that use that combine ayahuasca and cannabis.
Yes, it's actually, as I understand it, I don't have extensive knowledge about it, but to the extent that I do, it's controversial. It's like anything, you know. My sort of favorite analogy is bluegrass music. You know, there are people that would have a heart attack if you introduced a new chord into it. You know, do you know what the metaphor I'm saying is making?
Sure.
They're making there. There are people that are purist and dogmatic about their whatever it is that they're into. You know.
Yeah.
And then there are other people that are more open about it. And the dogmatic purist ones would think the others are corrupting the tradition. You know, the ganja yoga, sort of similar, right? There are yoga people around who think, oh, my God, you know, you can't do drugs with yoga, you know?
Right.
But to me, that's dogma. And, you know, with all due respect to anyone listening to this, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of with combining these medicines in a knowledgeable, skillful, respectful way, you know.
I would assume that anybody who listens to this show regularly is not going to be offended by that statement.
Good, we're preaching it. And they also use there's another chapter on a similar theme by Francisco who is also involved with ayahuasca, studying to be a shaman, a ceremony leader, as actually leading ceremonies now, actually. And his chapter is something about a commingling of sacramental medicines, and he talks about that too. And one of the ways that cannabis comes into their cosmology, so to speak, is not in the ceremonies. In fact, most of the time they don't use cannabis in the ceremonies, and usually only in trusted inner kind of group where they know everybody well will they do that with him and with Mariano. But they also occasionally use cannabis doing the exact form of the ayahuasca ceremony that they otherwise would normally do, but replacing it with Santa Maria. They often drink it. They make it a little, because that's the way they take the ayahuasca, of course. So they do the same ritual where they have people line up and they come up and they have a little sip of it, you know. And sometimes they'll have a puff later on to top that up if it's too mild for people.
And that was something that you recommend in your chapter on group ceremony. You recommended eating cannabis at the beginning of the ceremony and then maybe later on to kind of kickstarting the experience with a puff or two of smoked. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, what I'd like to say about that, Jonathan, is that I made reference like a few times in the book of cannabis as the people's plant. I'm a little bit ginger about setting myself up as any kind of authority. I think cannabis is gracious, safe enough plant that people can find their own ways to work with it. The chapter on cannabis ceremonies is really meant as an offering for a starting point for people to do what they will with, you know. But yes, the reason for that was because I wanted to have the ceremony last for quite a while so we could do a fair amount of silent sitting meditation, mix it in perhaps with a bit of yoga, some chanting sort of thing, you know. And having something edible, of course, lasts longer.
And then
we've had a couple of puffs to kind of sharpen up that or top it up at a certain point. But it's not necessary to do that, of course. It's not necessary to do, you know, it could be either, you know, inhalation or oral ingestion. Again, it'll last longer, of course, if you do it with oral ingestion. And just as a caution for anyone who's somewhat inexperienced with oral intake of cannabis, just watch out for the dosage, folks.
Yeah. Most of the sort of horror stories that came out of Colorado in the first six or eight months or so were all like sort of really green people eating way too much edibles. That's whenever I talk to people about cannabis that have never eaten it, I'm like, you know, half a brownie, quarter of a brownie, see how you feel, wait 2 hours. Yeah. Cause it's people that have only smoked it. It's a whole other experience in some ways when you eat it. The slowness of the onset and the intensity of the experience.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned 2 hours because it can take a full 2 hours to reach peak effect. Yeah, absolutely. What was I going to say in regard to that? That, you know, even with smoking and vaporizing, you can have extremely intense effects as well. But of course, they come on basically suddenly rather than taking all that time to come on. Yeah. So there's an interview that I did with two medicine shamans. They work with iboga and ayahuasca primarily, but they've also done cannabis ceremonies and other vision quests and meditate. They're both really, really experienced, and actually I know them quite well personally. They're remarkable human beings, these two gentlemen from the UK. And they use cannabis to work with in their ceremonies. Steve calls it looking through a window. It opens up perceptions perceptions of what's going on that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. They can feel and almost see the energies of the group they're working with and respond to them at a deeper level when they open the window like that. So they have some very interesting things to say about how to use cannabis skillfully. Then Jeremy Wolfe, I already mentioned. Roger Christie, I'd heard about, was the head of something called the THC Ministry in Hawaii. And he's one of at least six people that I know of that have contributed to this book, by the way, who has done prison time for nothing more egregious than a commitment to cannabis as a sacrament. He spent approximately five years in federal prison for running the THC ministry in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So he has a chapter in there just describing how they do things and their basic philosophy. And we're almost done all this now, by the way. Stephen Hager is, in certain circles, a very well-known countercultural figure. He was among numerous other hats, as it were. He was the editor-in-chief of High Times magazine, as he says, off and on for 25 years during its heyday, its best circulation period. And he's got a lovely little chapter, kind of playful, actually, called The New Pot Enlightenment. And he makes the claim that cannabis is central to the transformation of consciousness revolution that's so needed on this beleaguered planet. And finally, I wanted to address a little bit about cannabis as a creative aid. Mm-hmm. So I wrote a short chapter about that, trying to lay down some basic ideas. And then I found this fellow, Floyd Salas, who's an award-winning novelist and poet. And he's a riot. You know, he talks about, he says, I smoke pot to write with love. Mm. So it's quite sweet and interesting. And finally, it's actually a friend of mine who lives here in Vancouver, Savea Vatch, is a remarkable jeweler who's had great international success with her, you know, individual hands-on kind of jewelry work. She doesn't mass produce anything or have employees, but she's just an artist, really. And she does beautiful work, and she works very closely with cannabis with her work, and has some very interesting things about how it opens up her connection to the stones. She works with stones a lot. Mm-hmm. She talks about getting into the stone zone, like where she, yeah, not stoned, but the zone of the stones. Uh-huh. Where kind of almost like the ancestry of the stones kind of reveals itself to her. This is almost a short chapter. It's only two or three pages, but it's quite revealing. So there you go. There's the quick rundown of all the contributors.
Yeah. Cool. I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about your own relationship with cannabis.
Hmm. Well, like a lot of people, I mean, it's one of the issues addressed in the book is, there's a lot of refinement and skill involved in having a healthy ongoing relationship with cannabis. Mm-hmm. It hasn't always been completely that way for me. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons is, I think it's talked about in the book sometimes, is that it's kind of a truth serum. It can make you vulnerable. You know, it can, you know, open things up and have you look at things more sharply and see your own sort of missteps and so on. If that goes along with issues of negative self-image or problems with self-esteem or being hard on yourself, that's one of the themes in the book, is that cannabis is an amplifier. Sometimes I like to call it a non-specific amplifier. So it's sort of with your attention, it can amplify that. And if your attention is going into some sort of negative self-talk or whatever, it can exaggerate that. So I experienced that when I was younger, occasionally in particular. Then the other aspect of carefulness that one sometimes needs to bring to one's relationship with cannabis is that, you know, when it goes well, when you have a good experience with it, it's exquisite. Oftentimes, it's a really beautiful space to enter. It's a very kind plant, and so it's very normal, even if you're not a particularly addictive person by nature, it's very normal to want to go back to a lovely, pleasurable experience. Mm-hmm. But that kind of has a backlash quality, I think, for a lot of people, because it can lead to dependence. Actually, that's also talked about by several of the contributors, including myself. Mariano is very clear on that. He uses the word addictive. Should clarify that on the physical level, for those who don't know or think it is, cannabis isn't really physically addictive to any severe degree. Millions and millions of people can attest to the fact that they smoked their brains out and then one day got up and said, oh, time to change. Mm-hmm. you know, perhaps they had a few off days while their system readjusted, but nothing remotely like, say, tobacco or alcohol. Or,
no, totally. You
know. Yeah. But psychological dependence is a major problem for some people, as we know. Mm-hmm. I play myself, I'm not setting myself up as a model for how anyone else should use cannabis. I try to follow the less is more principle to some degree, but it's tempting, but then what I've actually found is that it doesn't work. There's a diminishing returns kind of effect, you know, right. And again, that's different for everybody. And I should say here that, if anyone's listening to this who's a regular cannabis user, first of all, millions of people need it for medical reasons and they need it every day. No problem, of course. I would never judge that. And I don't actually have any judgment about people who use cannabis daily anyway. The only issue is, how is it serving your life? Mm-hmm. You in control of that? Or is it got you by the short hairs, you know, because of that seductive quality, you know, which it's not the plant's fault. It's our tendency to want to get something again that we really like. Right.
Sure.
But then there's a tolerance effect. There's a familiarity effect. And as Mariano da Silva says, cannabis has a transcendental effect. But if I use it every day, I lose that effect completely. Mm-hmm. So for me, you know, I try to balance my greed, as it were, with the clear experiential understanding that if I do it too often, it loses that wonderful sharpness and depth. Typically do it twice a week, very rarely more often than that, I might even do it less often, except that oftentimes one of those two times is my buddy Adrian comes over and we play music together. I've worked Adrian around to making it into a kind of a quasi ceremony. So we start with a kind of a gong and we do some dedications and prayers and we sit in silence for a few minutes, have a couple of puffs, literally two, usually not more. And then we sit again for another 5 or 10 minutes and then we play music. And sometimes we stop an hour or so later and do repeat that process. But because I like to do it alone in a kind of meditative way, I often want to have another night in there somewhere, you know, halfway between where I just do it by myself. Mm-hmm. And in those, I often make it a little ceremony as well, hit my little Tibetan, you know, bell gong thing. And sometimes, like actually just last night, it's not that I'm going to sit there with no thought all night, but I do sit in meditation more or less, and things come and things go. And sometimes I go for a little ride in my mind, and I get into some kind of a gestalt, you could say. And then a while later, I come back. And when I've come back from this little adventure, I just come back to my breath, and I sit up straight or stay sitting up straight and meditate for a while, and then some other flight of fancy might occur, and insights come about something I'm working on. I'll jot them down quickly, that sort of thing. You know, that's the way I work with it, and that leads me, if I may, go into this area now, because I can. For me, you know, you asked me before we went on air, you know, is there anything in particular I'd like you to ask me? And
yeah.
I said let's just improvise, but I want to stress that in my understanding, and it's by no means my understanding, I don't think my understanding, my personal manifestation understanding, is complete, but I've read a huge amount of other literature by people, spiritual teachers and so on, and there's one common theme that comes up over and over and over again, which is unconditioned reality is manifests or arises out of stillness. We have to quiet our minds down enough for there to be an opening. It's like Leonard Cohen said in the song, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Right. So there has to be a crack in your thinking process. Buddhist teachings talk about how the discursive thinking mind is ego's primary strategy for obscuring unconditioned reality, for obscuring the light, and keeping us protected in the known, in our what we consider our safe space. which in fact we actually never feel safe in because we always feel like we're having to struggle to keep it that way. But one has to allow some gap in that to open oneself up to unconditioned reality, or whatever word you want to put on it. I like that one because it's kind of, it's not, it doesn't carry a lot of baggage, mm-hmm. you know, it's like saying God.
Yeah.
The mystic poet, this 13th century mystic poet, Rumi, had quite a few things to say about that.
Yeah.
Like, silence is the language of God. All else is pure poor translation. Mm-hmm. And another one that I really like, look past your thoughts so you may drink the pure nectar of this moment. Mm-hmm. So, I talk about this in the book possibly more than the others. They've got their own focuses and so on. That I think it's really important to, as much as possible, or at least as some component or inclusion in your practice, in your way of working with cannabis, if you'd like it to be a spiritual ally for you, to come back to the wellspring of silence as much as possible. And it's also important to say, I think, about that, that that can be very challenging because for a lot of people, cannabis stimulates ideas. And that's both, you know, a great thing in itself, but it's also interesting, kind of tricky thing in the sense, for the same reason that I talked about before, that discursive thinking is ego's primary strategy for obscuring the light. So we think, oh, I'm having this great idea, you know, and you want to pursue it or whatever. But that can also be ways that we trick ourselves into finding, as Eckhart Tolle said, the now is never enough for people. You know? It's like you have to be somehow willing to embrace nothingness, as it were. A little, sometimes maybe you just have to make a relationship with that, even though you're kind of freaking or finding it boring or irritating or whatever, so that it can develop. A phrase that I use over and over again from the Buddhist teachings that I find so concise is emptiness becomes luminosity. Emptiness means emptying out all that obscuration that we put in front of, between us and unconditioned reality. And once we allow ourselves to surrender and relax into that emptiness, it can be disorienting or even scary, but it opens up to luminosity potentially as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had gave a short, story at an event in, Viroqua, Wisconsin, a weekend ago. And I was talking about how the most powerful entheogenic experience that I've ever had in my life versus the most challenging entheogenic experience that I've had in a great long time, both happened in this past year. And I was reflecting on how the two were similar, and that in both there was a radical loss of sense of self. And the only thing that was different about the two things was my reaction to that loss. So in that peak experience, that what I would say is the best day of my life, when I first tried 5-MeO-DMT, it was just like a complete embrace of, yes, this is what I want. I watched myself die, and there was just a complete loss of ego, and it was totally liberating. And then I had an experience right before the U.S. Thanksgiving holiday where I had probably the most challenging entheogenic experience that I've had in like a decade. And there was also this profound loss of self, sense of self. But my reaction to it was like, no, don't go there. I'm not ready to see that. I'm not ready to lose that. And so it was like fear and pain and suffering that I inflicted upon myself. And it's taken me, you know, months to recover from that. And so it, you know, it's interesting. There's, I don't know if you're familiar with the movie called Jacob's Ladder.
I think I saw it years ago. I don't remember much about it. Well, there's this surrealistic psychedelic.
Yeah. And it's kind of about this guy who's like, he's like dying and he's like reliving his life. And there's this person who's kind of like his guide. It's his chiropractor. And he has this line where he says that, you know, when it seems like when you look around you, it seems like there's demons stripping your life away. But when you just look at it in a different way, what you see is that they're really angels freeing your soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Well, that's kind of the core message was working with these amplifying agents, right? We could talk all night about fear because fear is so clever. When I talked about the discursive mind being ego's primary strategy, well, fear is kind of like the puppet master guiding the whole thing. The fear part of ourselves, the fear character or voice in ourselves, is the one that absolutely cannot abide by any threat to this fortress, to this status quo, to this ego, and will come up. It is extremely intelligent and will come up with the most elaborate and clever stories to convince us that anything that threatens this status quo, is to be rejected and so on. But when you get into these, it doesn't necessarily have to involve the amplification effects of a medicine. I mean, it could be in just meditating or just in life, period. Mm-hmm. But when you get into an amplified state with the entheogens, I've experienced this a lot with ayahuasca, where such a powerful medicine, you're sitting there in the Santo Daime, you sit upright. Actually, it's really different mm-hmm. from the Peruvian, lie down in the dark and the shaman sings the Icaros, sitting upright, and there's a lot of singing going on oftentimes. But still, like what I found in that environment is that it's a very good container for making it really clear where I am with this process of surrendering. And I see myself go through all these machinations of trying to get away from the now, as it were, avoid surrendering. And then a lot of times I just get to a point where I go, no, okay, there's nothing you can do. There's no way around it. You can't talk your way around any of this stuff. There's only one thing you can do, and that's keep your feet to the fire without any sort of support rationally for doing that. Your fear is going to try to convince you that you should not do that. But you just, it's trust. Trust is a big word that's come up for me in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. You just have to trust based on the most shaky, tentative faith, that the only way to wake up spiritually is to just let go, surrender, pay attention, and ride that experience,
Terence McKenna said, you have to dive into the abyss and you discover it's a feather bed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, old Buddhist teacher Trigong Trungpa had one of these little anecdotes. Was he used the metaphor of a monkey, I think, and he's saying the monkey's on this platform, sort of like the floor of a house that hasn't been built, mm-hmm. a platform. And the monkey's always afraid to go near the edge of the platform because it assumes that there's an abyss on the edge, over the edge of the platform. But if the monkey ever, screws up the courage to go and look over the edge, the great joke, as it were, the cosmic joke is that the platform is sitting on the ground. Or maybe there's something else about when you fall, you are going to land on a feather bed, or you're going to be caught, or you're going to float, or you're going to fly, or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. How did he put it? Oh, yeah. You ever heard of a little book called The Lazy Man's Guide to Enlightenment?
No.
Oh, it's a lovely little book. It was published in the early 70s. It was very popular and was in print for a very long time, even though the guy died about 20 years ago. His name is Thaddeus Golas, G-O-L-A-S. Very small book. His experiences were primarily based on LSD, his experience with LSD, but very interesting. And he had a number of little sayings in the book, and one of them was, when you learn to love hell, you'll be in heaven.
Mm.
The demons are your own projection
right.
of threat, right? It's this ego, it's this fear, say, throwing these, projecting, creating these characters that are threatening, as we've been talking about, if you can not run away, then things change, things transform.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things too, that, I didn't see, I haven't read every page of this book, but, is that I haven't seen is, and maybe you can speak on if you have experience on it, because I've found that there's, you can, that I personally have been able to achieve a really profound state of no mind when combining cannabis with sexuality. That, you know, and if my partner and I are really intoxicated on cannabis and there's that moment of climax, and it sometimes it'll just, it's just a complete erasure of sense of self, and, you know, very similar to some of the strongest entheogenic experiences that I've ever had.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you know, I don't have an immense amount of experience with completely transcendent sexual experiences, but enough to know that, you know, that it's possible, that's for sure, without any substance involved, let alone with the amplifying effect of cannabis. Yeah, no, I didn't. None of us really talked about the, you know, it could have been a chapter in there, really, you know, cannabis and sexuality or something like that. Or I hope the point was made in the book that because of its amplifying capabilities, it depends on your intention and how you channel that energy. Mm-hmm. And so that can be anything, you know, that you apply your focus to. You know, it can amplify the intensity, the depth of that experience.
My wife Nicole and I have told people a number of times that if they are feeling tension in their relationship, that a regular experience of cannabis sex can be life altering or relationship altering, because it can help you to really connect to one another in, you know, in honesty and amplify that heart energy. And it's also just like, just very unifying when you're in that space and you combine it with that, you know, that amplifying energy of cannabis with the sexual encounter can be very healing for, you know, if you're in a position of having difficulty in your relationship.
Yeah. Very interesting. Well put, Jonathan. Yeah.
So a couple of the things that are covered in here, we talked a little bit about dosage and about keeping it through your regularity in order to intensify that experience. The less regular you have of a usage, the more intense the experience is likely to be, which I think many people would agree with. I would totally agree with that. I have many times in my life regularly taken deliberate breaks from cannabis in order to kind of rekindle the flame, so to speak, to kind of get back to that intensity of experience when I felt like it was kind of starting to get more rote, or that, you know, my tolerance was building up and I wasn't having the effects that I wanted to have with it. And then one of the other things that you talked about smoking versus vaporizing. Could you touch on that a little bit?
Sure. I'd like to say about the frequency of use issue. Several of the contributors talk about the less is more in the actual encounter, in the dosage. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting one, because it can go different ways. It could be more is more as well. You know, mm-hmm. One that I said, I think in the book, that I like to say is that in some way the optimal dosage is the dosage that you want to and can handle. So when I say handle, I mean be able to hold your seat, as they say, be able to stay present with and be able to allow some gap and space in the thinking mind, you know, the no mind that you mentioned a moment ago. So, but there's also this interesting exploration edge of seeing how much you can benefit from a small dosage, that there's a refinement in that, you know, for people. And then again, you know, less frequent, you know, we already talked about earlier in the conversation, can have sharper effects. So that's the dosage issue is an interesting one that way. And then what was the second thing you asked about there?
Going a little deeper into that. I think that one of the sort of fears that people have, or if people have negative experiences with cannabis, I think it tends to be when they sort of get into these, like for me, if I do too much, I get into very emotional places where small things get amplified in my mind, and I like, oh, you know, I'm get really emotional about a particular thing that someone says to me, or I think too much about something that's going on in my life, and it gets blown up to the to this place of like being all encompassing, or just, you know, one of the common things that people describe is like the paranoia. So you get paranoid about something. And I think that especially on with the cannabis that is, that's, you know, in places where like, here in Michigan, and in, this in places where it's legal, even for recreational use, there's really, there's just really intense strains out there now that are so much different than the stuff that was floating around when, you know, we were kids. When I was a kid, it was like, you know, this stuff that came from, was packaged in someone's door frame from Mexico, and it wasn't even, hadn't even been cured, and it was full of seeds and stems, and I don't know what the THC content was of that stuff, but it was like this, the stuff we have now is clearly vastly superior in some ways. But you know, being really careful about not overdoing it, I think is you can't stress that enough. Especially if you're trying to get spiritual or creative benefit out of it, once you get over that sort of hump, I think there can be a space where you can, if you could go beyond that, you can really sort of, you know, get into interesting places. But there is that space where, you know, when you go just a little bit overboard and you get kind of like freaked out and you maybe don't have somebody that knows what they're doing that can kind of help coach you through it. It's wise to just kind of avoid that.
Yeah, well, that's where I think why somebody like Hamilton Souther thinks that, you know, the ideal circumstances is to do it in a ceremonial context where there's a container and someone guiding it as well, you know, so that you can keep moving with that energy. So, yeah, that's why I said that perhaps the optimal dosage is how much you want to and can handle and hold your seat. Well, I also make the point in the book that, you know, if you feel like you're not handling it well, that doesn't automatically mean that you've done too much, because you may be able to work with the energy in the moment. So you were talking about the, you know, the thought stuff. I mean, that's so key, you know, because of its amplifying effects. Anything can be amplified. So that's why I said earlier that negative ideation can be amplified. Paranoid thoughts can be amplified. Things take on an exaggerated, out of perspective, you know, thoughts take on an exaggerated and out of perspective perspective. So, and that's why, you know, I think it's really important to recognize that, you know, thoughts are just thoughts in that moment. And that's a basic, you know, spiritual teaching as well. You know, that's why they have these simple follow the breath kinds of meditations, is that you're taught to allow the thoughts to come up, see them, not judge them, whether they seem to be positive or negative. And thoughts includes emotions and everything, all of it, you know, anything that's in your mind, as it were, and just allow it to come and go and come and go. And eventually you start to realize that you're not those thoughts. They don't have to guide you by the balls, as it were, or you astray or whatever. You can see them come up no matter what they are, you know, whether they're desires, whether they're judgments, whether they're anger, sadness, happiness, whatever they are, you can just allow it all to come and go. It's all insubstantial stuff that happens in the moment. And so cannabis is an amplifier again, and it can amplify all those, you know, kind of problematic thoughts. But this is where it becomes a spiritual ally if you can channel the energy into openness, into at least a degree of no mind, then that's where it's really got this amazing potential. And then again with dosage, one thing I think I said in the book is that there may be sort of a loose equation or whatever you call it, where the stronger the dosage, the less you may want to be doing activity-wise. So that, you know, for example, Neil Young wrote a lot. I don't know, probably the great majority of all those wonderful songs under the influence of cannabis. But in his autobiography, tells a little anecdote about this. I think it was a particularly strong strain that he had at the time. But he said, if you smoked a little, you wrote a song. If you smoked a lot, you were just toast. So, you know, for creative work and that sort of thing, and maybe even just for sort of simple, peaceful meditation, a light dose can be very beneficial. And then there's this other you know, kind of going into the deep thing that you could potentially do if you're, and I think the stronger the dosage, the more your experience and ability to handle that dissolution, as it were, becomes important in the container, that you're in a, you know, quiet, safe place, as it were. You don't have to deal with distractions and so on, or problems, you know, around you. That's like a meditative environment, right? Mm-hmm. Then potentially you can go deep with it, and there can be a stronger dissolution, you know?
Thank you. Well, we're getting close to the end of our hour, but this is psychedelic parenting. And I know you're not a parent yourself, but there's a number of people who are contributors to your book that I know personally. I know that their parents, Chris Bennett and Julie and Jeremy. So let's talk let's kind of end this with the question of how old is old enough when it comes to cannabis? Because I know that there's a lot of different viewpoints out there regarding cannabis in young minds. And I'd like to hear what you think, what your personal opinion is on that.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it's fixed for starters. And I certainly wouldn't want anyone to think that I consider myself an authority on the matter. Again, cannabis is the people's plant, and it's for us to work with and to us to find out what works and what doesn't. Given that, there, I think, are some misunderstandings out there, and there's some debatable issues. Mm-hmm. One of them being the damage to the developing brain. There are people that are insisting that people should stay away from cannabis until the brain is fully developed. Well, supposedly that would be 25. Nobody's going to wait that long. So out of the question. Others would say, let's find a reasonable compromise and make it 21 or something like that. But first of all, you can't tell kids not to smoke pot.
Right.
But from, and I haven't done all the reading on it, I'm sure, but from what I've come across, that isn't still not a settled question.
I would agree.
There's a difference between correlation and causation, for one thing. Mm-hmm. Right? There's a saying about correlation is not causation. And there's a lot of other factors that come into it. And the fact that it has an effect on the brain doesn't mean that it's proved that there's a damaging effect on the brain.
Sure.
Some people might say the opposite because if you can be present with the plant, particularly if you can relax with it, and this is why I do feel that in general it's better to do it more consciously, more aware, you know, so that you can actually, am I breathing? Am I relaxed? Am I able to get out of my head a little bit and allow the energy of the plant? I often consider cannabis an energy medicine. Allow that energy to move freely. This is what, I won't go into it now, but Joan Bellow talks about, you know, that flow, that increased flow of freshly oxygenated blood, which is very healthy medicinally or medically, but also it's not different from spiritually that way and psychologically. Health-giving plant when you use it well that way. And that could be the case for young people as well. I'm not encouraging anybody to do that. They got to find out for themselves with their parents and so on. But I'm saying let's keep an open mind about all that for now. Mm-hmm. There may be further research that shows that there is some kind of organic damage to the developing brain, but I think what's happening with the naysayers is there's a bit of dogma going on there, and they're saying, well, the brain is still developing, so cannabis must be negative on that.
Sure. Personal experience, I began smoking cannabis, not heavily, but I mean my first experience was like in the seventh grade, and I was a very good student, and I had up until my mid-30s, I had what I would have described as a photographic memory. And I mean, I smoked very heavily as an undergraduate and did very well in school. And so I don't think that, you know, that you can easily say that this is some sort of, you know, super damaging thing. In fact, I think when you can look and see that many extremely creative people in many different endeavors are also cannabis users. So
absolutely,
you know, you have to take that as it is.
Yeah. And another thing that I think is important for people to think about too, and it already is being discussed and worked with, is that the cannabis as a medicine can be very beneficial, it seems. It's starting to show more and more promise for dealing with conditions and problems that occur to sometimes very young people, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, talking about even infants and so on, you know, that are having problems. Nothing is coming to mind exactly right now, but, you know, seizures,
for example. Yeah, there's some seizure disorders, yeah.
You know, there can be issues that can be benefited by cannabis at a very young age. Mm-hmm. And they're not necessarily, I just don't see any research that shows that cannabis has an automatic damaging effect.
Right on.
Right.
Yeah.
So we come to the end of our hour, Stephen. So once again, I just want to thank you for being on the show. You always come with really interesting things, and you have a huge collection of wonderful people that you whose wisdom you bring along every time we talk, and I really appreciate that every time. So the book is called Cannabis and Spirituality. It's edited by Stephen Gray with a foreword by Julie Holland. It's published by Park Street Press. And it's available on Amazon. We will include a link in the podcast notes. So thank you so much, Stephen, for being on the program.
You're welcome. And write me, folks, StephenGrayMadison@gmail.com, or go to the website, CannabisandSpirituality.com, and the Facebook page, Cannabis and Spirituality. Love to be in contact with people about this. It's an exciting area of, and perhaps essential area of the development in our cultures.
Wonderful. Thank you again.
Thanks, Jonathan.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
My advice is to learn from your children, and perhaps eventually, when you're spiritually ready, you'll turn on with your children if you think that's the right thing to do.
Your ties and your friends and your associations.